From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As you putter around your garden making decisions about what and where to plant, you probably haven't given this idea much thought. Your lawn, your garden, your yard are all part of this region's ecosystem. With the move towards living greener, perhaps as we make landscaping decisions, it's time to start thinking about our little plots of land as smaller parts of a greater whole. Increasingly, non-native plants have been showing up in the suburban landscape, and although they provide visual interest, these plants take the place of native plants that play a role in other parts of nature other than simply the visual component. Experts worry that our local ecosystem has been damaged by the innocent actions of homeowners and commercial businesses who think they're doing the right thing. The good news is that the damage can be reversed with a better understanding of sustainable development and environmentally friendly landscaping. Today's program is meant to shed some light on that, and we're joined by Ernie McClaney, who is the program coordinator for Central Piedmont Community College's new Center for Sustainability. As a member of the Mecklenburg County Park and Recreation Stewardship Advisory Council and a board member of the local North Carolina Wildlife Federation chapter, Mr. McClaney is spearheading efforts to make each of the CPCC campuses certified wildlife habitats. I thought that all college students were wildlife.
It's a different
other variety.
We'll talk about how you're doing that in a couple of seconds here. And we welcome back Carol Bowie Jackson, a habitat steward with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, a master composter and avid gardener. Her backyard was certified as a backyard wildlife habitat in 1999 by the National Wildlife Federation. We probably talked about this when you were here before, but I don't recall, and I don't know how that happens, but we'll talk about that too.
Okay.
Carol and her husband, Jay, also run the website smelllikedirt.com.
Yes,
you don't,
sir.
By the way.
Well,
you don't.
Thank you. Not yet today.
Okay.
It's early.
And Dr. Doug Talamy is also with us. Dr. Talamy is professor and chair of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware. He's also the author of what our first two guests consider to be the definitive book on native plants, bringing nature home, how native plants sustain wildlife in our gardens. And he joins us by phone from the University of Delaware. Dr. Talamy, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Nice to have you with us. You folks say that ordinary people are damaging the ecosystem through the use of non-native plants, and that ordinary people can fix the problem by changing course, reversing direction. Just how badly have we damaged the local ecosystem here, in your opinion, since both of you live here and both of you are working in various different areas to fix this?
Well, we lose about 41 acres a day of natural habitat. And as you said in your introduction, we have not done, ordinary gardeners, homeowners, we have not done this on purpose. We thought we were doing a good thing. We're landscaping. We're increasing our property values. But what we haven't taken in consideration is the native wildlife that we're pushing out of the area when we bring in these non-native species.
And you're not just talking about plants. When you plant a non-native bush or tree or something, you're saying that it does not attract the kind of wildlife that normally is attracted to our backyards. I'm paraphrasing here, but is that essentially accurate?
That's correct. The insects that have been here for hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions, have an eco-relationship with the vegetation that they existed with way back then. And when we remove those and put in these new exotics or invasives, that relationship is broken. And the insects may have to move on to other locations. And so when insects move on, it creates a domino effect. The birds or other creatures that eat insects have to move on as well.
Dr. Talamy, you've written that our yards really are a, quote, wildlife preserve that represents the last chance that we have for sustaining plants and animals that were once common throughout the United States, and that they will increasingly function that way in the future. Do most people think that way, or is this a new way of thinking? This is new information to most people.
Right. It was new to me as well until I started to look at the amount of area that we've taken for our own use. You know, we have about 41% of the U.S. in agriculture and about 54% in cities and suburbs. So that leaves 5% that's relatively pristine. So if we've got 95% of the U.S. in managed ecosystems, we've got to manage those ecosystems in ways that protect the things that used to live there. You're not going to get all the biodiversity of the U.S. surviving in 5% of the land.
And at what point did you come to that conclusion? Where did you get those figures, and at what point did they become clear to you that if that's the way things are, then we need to be very careful?
I recognize the relationship between, you know, plants are the first trophic level. They're producing, you know, they're capturing the energy from the sun and turning it into food for all the animals that are out there. So if we mess with that first trophic level, we mess with that relationship, we're threatening the production of food for everything, at least in the U.S. So when I realized that that's exactly what we're doing by bringing in all these alien plants, and people talk about invasive species and that's all we're worried about, and they say, well, my plant's not invasive, so I don't have to worry about it. But in fact, whether it's invasive or not, if it evolved in another country or in another continent, and we bring it here and we plant it by the millions everywhere, it is still comprising the first trophic level.
What kind of plants are we talking about? Well, in other words, give me an example of a non-native plant that has become prolific in this country and that is in fact doing some damage to the ecosystem.
Well, let's just talk about ornamental plants. We'll forget the invasive plants. I mean, kudzu is a great invasive
yeah.
plant that you know all about. But let's talk about the ornamental plants that are in your yard. I bet there's Pieris japonica. I'll bet it's loaded with azaleas from Asia. As a matter of fact, at least in my neighborhood, I started walking around and looking at the composition of plants in the local suburban ecosystems. And for example, my neighbor has 10 acres, and every single one of the plants he's landscaped with are non-native. So he's completely removed the native vegetation and replaced it with ornamentals that he, you know, he bought at the local nursery. The interesting thing is my neighbor doesn't know anything about plants. He doesn't know whether it's native or not. He doesn't really care. He simply wanted a landscape that was acceptable to himself and to the neighbors. So he asked a landscaper to come do it, and the end result was that everything, all the natives were removed and all the aliens were put in. So you know, you go right down the line. Most of the conifers, well, down your way, I guess you've got a lot of native pines, but in our area, we don't have a lot. We've got white pine, and that's about it.
Well,
so people plant Douglas firs and all the things that don't belong in Delaware.
Well, let's bring it home to Charlotte here, because we've got two Charlottians sitting here, and both of them are actively involved in this. If you drive through an average Charlotte neighborhood, mm-hmm. what are the plants that strike you as being, well, that stick out for you, and you say, oh, my God, get that out of here?
In Charlotte, the prime example is English ivy. It's everywhere.
Now, English ivy is what?
English ivy.
To me, ivy is ivy. So what is English
ivy? Well,
let's
just call it ivy, because almost every ivy that we have growing here is non-native. It's what everybody's using in their yard. You see it going up the trees. And what it represents is a monoculture. It's forcing out the native plants that could be growing there. A lawn is another great example, just your average lawn. Lawns are the biggest crop that Americans spend money. Or we spend more money on crops than any other crop in America.
Why do you hate Charlotte? Lawns are like the flag here. What's
I know. And I'm not asking to get rid of them. I'll just reduce them just a little bit.
So lawns are non-native.
Lawns are non-native.
Why? Because meadowlands weren't native to
well,
the region?
Well, meadowlands, if you look at a meadow and you think, wow, you know, that looks like all the same plant, right? If you get down and look at it, it's not. There's a lot of different types of plants
that
are growing
in a meadow.
Tell me about
it. I know that,
mm-hmm,
yes.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so it's diversity. That's the big key is diversity. You don't want all of one thing anywhere.
Dr. Tallamy mentioned azaleas. Are the azaleas mm-hmm. that are so prolific here mm-hmm. non-native?
Non-native. The best way to tell if they're native or non-native mm-hmm. is do they have their leaves in the wintertime? If they're evergreen, they're non-native. Those are an Asian species. Our native azaleas are gorgeous, but they're deciduous. They drop their leaves in the wintertime, and you just can't believe the fragrance from a native azalea. So if you encounter a native azalea, you'll know it because they just smell. You'll smell them before you see them.
Now, I know that we are experiencing climate creep. I know that the people who keep the maps of what grows where and when are changing the map slowly because the environment is changing, the climate is changing, and so plants that would not have survived the winter here are now surviving.
Mm-hmm.
I have a palm tree in my backyard. Is that a bad thing?
It's maybe not a bad thing, but it's not a native. It's not supporting
right.
any of the native wildlife here.
You want to chime in on this?
No, other plants that we see in the Charlotte community are the ligustrums and the Russian olives.
What are Russian olives? I read about them yesterday. What are they?
It's an evergreen shrub.
Okay.
You'll find it in almost every big box garden center.
Non-native. Okay.
And they reproduce very quickly, as do the ligustrum. Mm-hmm. And they can get out of the planting zone, landscape size, overgrow their bounds very mm-hmm. quickly.
I was also, and I knew about this, but I was looking through a list, and I think this came from Dr. Ptolemy. I'm not sure exactly where it came from. I was looking through a list yesterday of various different plants that are used around the country, and they are ranked in terms of their threat level to the ecology. And I always knew that you're not supposed to have mimosa.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why, because they're lovely. I mean, they're beautiful and they smell good, but they are a severe threat. They are characterized as a severe threat.
Yes, and the problem with non-natives is in their country, where they're the countries of origin, there's a system in place to keep them in check. They have a pest, a disease, a fungus, or something in the native soil there, in their ecosystems, that keeps them from taking over. When you bring them here, whatever it is that keeps them in check in their native land is absent here. So they just run amok, and they're forcing out native plants.
This comes actually, I believe, from the North Carolina Plant Society, Native Plant Society, this list of severe threats. Let me go through the list of severe threat plants, and tell me how prolific they are here. Mm-hmm. Tree of Heaven, never heard of it.
Oh, yes. Very prolific here.
Garlic mustard. Never heard. Alligator weed.
Nope.
Okay. Asian bittersweet.
Yes.
Russian olive, you've already mentioned. Yep. Autumn olive.
Yes.
English ivy, you've already mentioned. Hydrilla.
Mm-hmm.
Bicolor lespediza. Is that how you say
Bless
that?
You.
Chinese privet.
Yeah, privet. Mm-hmm.
Fragrant honeysuckle. Is that the honeysuckle that's everywhere?
Yes, that white. The white Japanese honeysuckle.
That's
yes.
not a good thing?
That's not a good thing.
Japanese honeysuckle?
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
It's part of the fragrant honeysuckle. It's also the white and the yellow.
And they're not native?
No.
They're everywhere.
They're everywhere. And yeah. they choke out natives.
And I've been pulling it out of my backyard for 10 years.
Wow. All right. Japanese stilt grass. I'm not sure what that is.
Terrible up here, Mike.
Really? What is
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. So is garlic mustard, by the way.
Okay.
There's an estimate that garlic mustard is growing in every acre east of the Mississippi.
Wow.
Wow. And that's a bad thing because?
Because it's replacing all the understory vegetation that should be in a forest. It also exudes nasty chemicals from its roots into the soil that prevents other things from germinating. So when an acorn falls and it's surrounded by garlic mustard, it probably will be killed before it can germinate. Whereas in the old days, it would germinate and you'd have a new forest coming along.
Hmm. Well, we have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more with Dr. Doug Ptolemy, who's joining us by phone from the University of Delaware, professor and chair of entomology in the Wildlife Ecology Department there, and the author of Bringing Nature Home. Also with us in our studio, Ernie McClaney from CPCC, the New Center for Sustainability, and Carol Bowie Jackson, a habitat steward with the Wildlife Federation. Our program is made possible in part today by Hendrick Lexus in Charlotte, presenting the LS. The experience is available for test drives at Hendrick Lexus, your local Lexus dealer, and by Hunton and Williams, a global law firm that believes the practice of law should include community service. More information on Hunton and Williams' legal capabilities online at hunton.com. Tomorrow on this program, an encore presentation. We're coming up to the 4th of July. We thought we'd revisit one of our shows on beer. Earlier this year, Mooresville was the site for the 18th annual homebrew competition, the U.S. Open homebrew competition. People from around the country flocked here to share their and be judged by their homemade beers. With so many beers out there for everybody to drink, it makes you wonder why people would go to all the trouble to brew their own. We found out why, and we found out a lot more about craft beers, and you can hear all about it tomorrow at 9.
Last month, the Dow Jones Industrial Average suffered its biggest one-month loss since 1930. A look at the ongoing turmoil in the financial and housing sectors and the prognosis for the U.S. economy in the weeks and months ahead. The Diane Rehm Show, Wednesday.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 FM WFAE.
WFAE explores the lighter side of storytelling.
Well, I used to be a karaoke DJ in a restaurant, and I used to always cab drive, so the restaurant closed down, so I just put it on the road, put it in my car, and started driving around.
If you missed a recent feature on Charlotte's one and only karaoke cab, you'll find it and other past stories in our news archives at our website, WFAE.org.
Shake that healthy mug! Baby got that!
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins in our studio. Ernie McClaney from CPCC, Carol Bowie Jackson, a habitat steward with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. And on the phone from the University of Delaware is Dr. Doug Tallamy, whose book, Bringing Nature Home, How Native Plants Sustain Wildlife in Our Gardens, is characterized by our two Charlotte guests as being the definitive book on native plants. Carol Bowie Jackson, Dr. Tallamy, says that your book is the one that clearly and succinctly makes the case that as development wipes out wildlife habitat, that we need to make a place for it in our own yards. This is something that's happening not just in Delaware and not just in this area. It's happening all over the country, right?
You know, it's happening all over the world. The big problem is when we remove native plants, we're removing the plants that make food for everything else. I like to talk about birds because people care about birds.
Mm-hmm.
But 96% of the birds, the terrestrial birds in the U.S., rear their young on insects. So you're not going to have any birds if you don't have the insects to support those birds, particularly during, while they're reproducing. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're designing landscapes. We choose our plants because they're pest-free, meaning you never see an insect on them, which means the birds have nothing to eat. Now, in the old days, they would go to the nearby woodlot or to the mountaintop that still existed, and they do all right there. But we've taken so much of the land now that they're not doing all right. And bird populations are declining everywhere in the country. That's just a symptom. As a matter of fact, the state natural heritage folks are assessing all the species in the U.S., all the plants and all the and the animals, and their estimate is that we've got about 33,000 species in trouble in the U.S.
Mm.
So that's what I'm talking about. We've got to put the food and the habitat back for these species.
Now you're talking
that in our own yard.
You're an entomologist, so for you it starts with bugs, but.
Right?
But you're talking about the food chain, and the food chain doesn't stop with birds. It goes right to us, correct?
Absolutely.
So we are impacting through innocent means here. We're having an impact on our own survivability.
That is the key point. We cannot exist on this planet as the only species. We depend on healthy ecosystems. We do not get everything we need from the mall, as most people think. We get it from healthy ecosystems, and those ecosystems run by a diversity of plants and animals. And as we wipe them out, the ecosystems become more and more fragile, and they will get to the point where they collapse. They have already collapsed in a number of places, particularly you see this in Africa quite a bit. And we're blessed in the U.S. by having benign climate for the most part, a lot of rain in most areas. And they're healthy ecosystems. They can take a lot, but we're giving them a lot, and they're not going to last forever. We've got to keep them jam-packed with the diversity of plants and animals that run them so that we can have the ecosystem services that support us. We can be entirely selfish about this. We don't have to get warm and fuzzy and say, oh, I want to save all the animals. I mean, that's nice, and I think we have the moral responsibility to do that. But if you disagree with that, then the argument's over. But if you look at it from a selfish perspective, saying, I need oxygen, I need clean water, I need carbon to be sequestered, I need my garbage to be recycled, and on and on and on, all the ecosystem services that these ecosystems provide for us, then you realize, this is why I need the biodiversity around me. We're going to be very unhappy when we finally realize that, killing off everything else was a huge mistake. And it's a non-renewable natural resource. Biodiversity is non-renewable because when these species are extinct, they are gone. They're not coming back.
Ernie McClaney is in charge of the new Center for Sustainability at CPCC, and his goal is to turn all of the CPCC campuses into wildlife habitats. Carol Bowie Jackson is a habitat steward, and her backyard has been proclaimed to be a wildlife habitat by the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. We're not just talking about the food chain here. We're also talking about habitat, places for animals to live. And in an area like Charlotte and the surrounding region, with tremendous, incredible growth year after year after year, we are wiping out places for these animals to live, which also has an impact, does it not, on biodiversity?
That's correct. And that's one of the reasons why at Central Piedmont Community College we have created wildlife habitats. And currently five of our six campuses are officially certified by the National Wildlife Federation. And it's one of the points of creating those habitats is to show that even in an urban area, like our central campus, which is right downtown Charlotte, you can create and bring back wildlife just by making a few small changes. You don't have to go in a big way. You can start out small. We put in things like winterberry, beautyberry, milkweed, coneflowers, elderberries, yupon hollies, just a variety.
And so amidst all those concrete buildings and all that pavement and all the sidewalks, et cetera, what you have done is do what you could in the area that you had available to you to make it hospitable.
And we're already seeing results of it in wildlife. There are more birds there now. Just a couple of weeks ago, one of our grounds maintenance persons spotted a raccoon right there at Central Campus. And each of our campuses is a different biodiversity area. I know you don't like raccoons.
It's not that I don't like them.
This was a good raccoon.
They just dug up my entire backyard last winter. It's like a war zone. So tell me something good about raccoons.
They're just part of the whole ecocycle, and there's room for them just like there's room for humans. And
can you – you have a backyard that was designated, Carol, as mm-hmm. a national – as a wildlife habitat. Describe it for us. I mean, most people have very well strived – people care. They strive mm-hmm. for these very well-manicured yards where the grass is cut and it's sculpted and the little rings around the trees with mulch and pine straw and everything is, sculpted. What does yours look like?
Well, and that's one of the errors in thinking about a habitat is that it has to be messy and it doesn't have to be. My personal yard, because I'm kind of a messy person, I have grass that's growing there in an area because I have three dogs, so I do need some grass there, but I have a wooded area. It's very well defined. I also have a flower garden, kind of an English cottage garden look. There's just a riot of colors and different types of plants in there, and it is just alive with insects and bird activity. It's just to provide the elements of a habitat, which they're for, food, water, shelter, and places to raise young, it adds just another dimension to your yard. It makes it more dynamic because there's just lots of activity going on out there. I stood out there, I have the website, so I was doing filming this weekend, and within a half an hour, I bet I saw 15 different species of animals out there, from chipmunks and squirrels and snakes and box turtles and birds and insects. So it's just alive with activity.
Your website is really quite something, and if people want to go see what you're talking about, is that snake video still on the website?
The snake video is still there.
It's smelllikedirt.com, and it's kind of like a mini Discovery Channel.
Thank you.
Locally oriented. It really is quite remarkable. Go ahead.
I'd like to point people also to the Central Piedmont Community College website, where they can see some photographs of our various campus wildlife habitats. And that address is www.cpcc.edu/CFS, as in Center for Sustainability.
cpcc.edu/CFS. We were talking a second ago about insects and birds and insects not finding the plants that they traditionally have feasted on. And insects play a role not just in eating, but they play a role in pollinating. And without pollination, we don't eat. Mm-hmm. The bees have been disappearing, and no one seems to know what's causing this so-called colony collapse, where the bees fly out from the colony and completely disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Could this be, Dr. Ptolemy, what's going on? Is this that they're going out looking for food and not finding it, and they're just dying on the way back?
Oh, in the case of the honeybee, probably not. That's a curious situation. The honeybee itself is non-native. It comes from Europe, and we brought it over here to pollinate most of our agricultural crops, which are also non-native. So that's not the type of interaction that we're really talking about.
Okay.
honeybees are disappearing because we have managed them poorly. We've got, you know, very little genetic diversity in these colonies. We have imported them from all over the world and brought in every pest you can imagine of honeybees, from all the different mites and viruses and diseases. And we stress them terribly by asking them to pollinate pecans in California, and we truck them thousands of miles. And so there's lots of reasons why the honeybees are in trouble, but we're foolish to rely on a single species to pollinate our plants when we have thousands of native bees that would do a reasonable job if we allowed them to do that. But in the meantime, in order to have our well, they're really fairly sterile agricultural landscapes, we've gotten rid of the habitat that supports all these native bees, including the alternative crops that they need to sustain their entire life cycle. Most blooming cycles for a crop are, you know, 1 or 2 weeks long. Mm-hmm. Well, what's the bee supposed to do the rest of the year if you don't have any food for it? So you've got to have a variety of pollens and nectars available for them. And if we used the thousands of species of native bees that we have, including all the bumblebees and all the tiny little ground nesting bees, our pollination success would be far higher than it is now, even without honeybees.
Why don't we do that? I mean, you're not the only entomologist in the country, so obviously there are other people that know what you know. So why hasn't this gotten hasn't the word gotten out?
Well, the word is getting out now, but you know, big agriculture isn't designed that way. We now have these blanket herbicides that you put down everywhere so that you don't have a weed problem. Well, that wipes out all the alternative pollen sources as well. So we have to using native bees is much easier when you have a small farming operation. When you have thousands of acres of a monoculture, unless you have areas in the middle of those crops for the bees to nest in, and alternative crops, they're not going to be able to survive. So we, you know, there's some redesigning that has to go on if we're going to rely on native bees.
If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE. You can also email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can join our blog, wfae.org/charlotteblogs. We have an email from Alan, who says, while not strictly on the topic, my pet landscape peeve is lawn poisoning services. He mentions one that I won't. I don't think most people realize the impact that insecticides in particular have on the environment. These pesticides do not target specific species, but kill harmful and beneficial insects equally well. These insects are important food sources for birds and reptiles and generally do very little damage to the lawn. It amazes me how much people are willing to sacrifice to have a green, one-species lawn, including exposing their children and pets to chemicals. Any comment from anybody?
I agree. It's the beauty of having a habitat where you're using a lot of natives and you've got a healthy ecosystem is that it doesn't take a lot of chemicals because it takes care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got insects in my yard, but I also have predators of those insects. So I just let nature take its course.
And if you feel like you do have to have a lawn service, you can ask them to not treat pesticides, and you can research those that treat the soil and not so much the grass, because if you have healthy soil, you don't need chemicals.
There's a great deal of evidence that's coming in now about the connection between these lawn care services and childhood cancers and also animal cancers. Individuals that are out crawling around in that lawn, like your cat and your dog and your child, are the ones that are exposed to these chemicals. And I was at a talk not too long ago. It's pretty scary. A lot of it's preliminary at this point, and they're wondering what's going to happen 20 years from now after this exposure. But it's something to think about.
And also, when you wipe out the insects, you're again contributing to that break in that cycle because, again, the birds have to move on. And so you're, again, destroying a natural environment throughout the neighborhood.
But what do you do for things like, lace bugs and
You know, the lace bug you have is the azalea lace bug. That's the most common ornamental pest that we have.
How did you know that? I have them all over the front yard. How did you know that?
Well, I, because.
Because he wrote the book on it.
I wrote the book, right. But that was imported with the azalea, with the azaleas from China. Most of our major pests, the Japanese beetles and you know, the woolly adelgids that are wiping out our hemlocks, these things came in with the ornamental industry itself. So, and, you know, the diseases that wiped out the American chestnut came in with Japanese chestnuts so that we could see what that looked like in our lawns. We've created so many of the huge problems we have by bringing in, with our fascination with plants from someplace else. Hmm.
Yeah, I have a great story. A friend said, you know, Japanese beetles, he called me, said, "Can I have Japanese beetles, what do I do? You know, they're eating me out of house and home." And I said, "Well, what are they eating?" And he said, "My crepe myrtles and my Japanese maples." I'm like, "Well, you invited them there because those are Asian Japanese species." So,
you know,
not only that, Japanese beetle larvae develop on grass roots. We have 45.6 million acres of grass in this country. So there's no mystery about why we've got a lot of Japanese beetles.
So we're giving them the plants they love to eat, and we're giving them surfaces on which they like to breed in abundance. But you keep mentioning plants that are known as Charlotte plants. I mean, crepe myrtle is the national tree of Charlotte, it seems to me. So if we took out all of these plants, if we got rid of all the crepe myrtles and... what would we have left? What would we plant?
Well, we need to replace with natives. And Dr. Tallamy makes the point in his book that we don't have to go in and cut down all the trees and start over. We can do it. We can do it. And Ernie made the point earlier, we can start small. So every time you have something die in your yard, replace it with a native. Every time you go to the store to buy something, you want a particular bush in this corner, choose a native species.
I mean, that list of plants that we went through a minute ago, the severe list of severely threatening plants, on the significant threat list is a tree that the city of Charlotte spent years planting and stopped now because it's a nasty tree. The Bartlett pear
exactly.
is on this significant threat list.
Right.
They are everywhere.
Well, and that's again kind of man's hubris comes into this when we think, oh, you know, we know best, and even though this doesn't grow here, we think it should, so we're going to bring it in and plant it. And then we find out in a few years, I'm going to stay.
You know, Mike, my dean is from South Carolina, and she read my book, and she said, you know, I want to work on my yard, but I love my crepe myrtle. I'm not going to give that up. You know, it's my heritage. And it brings up an interesting point. A lot of people have emotional connections to particular species. So that's fine. I just told my dean, don't make crepe myrtle the dominant plant in your yard. You can have some crepe myrtle, but if you have more natives than non-natives, instead of all non-natives, you'll still have gone a long way towards solving the problem.
Delaware is not terribly far from the D.C. area, and one of the big rites of spring in Washington is the Cherry Blossom Festival. Those trees were given to the D.C. area by Japan. They're
That's
non-natives, right.
right? That's right.
Are they causing problems?
Well, you know, they're not invasive in any way.
Okay.
So they're not spreading. When people say, is it causing a problem, I always think, you know, that plant is occupying a space. And it's occupying a space that could be occupied by a native plant that's being a lot more productive.
Okay.
It's a matter of scale.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this, and we'll go to your phone calls when we come back from the break as well. Stay with us, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by an Appalachian Summer Festival, June 28th through July 26th, while it's underway on the Appalachian State University campus in Boone, a month-long celebration of music, dance, theater, visual arts, and film. Details at 800-841-ARTS. And by Taylor Richardson Conger and TRCW, featuring hand-selected clothing and accessories for men and women. Phillips Place in Charlotte, shops on the Green Cornelius, trcstyle.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Reem Show, last month the Dow Jones Industrial Average suffered its biggest one-month loss since 1930, the Great Depression. A look at the ongoing turmoil in the financial and housing sectors and the prognosis for the U.S. economy in the weeks and months ahead. That's in the first hour, among the panelists, Gene Sperling, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a former member of the Clinton administration. And then in the 11 o'clock hour, most, if not all, major conflicts throughout history can be tied to competing belief systems. True believers try to make the world in their image and reject dialogue at odds with their ideology. A religious scholar, James Carse, examines the difference between faith and belief. His book is called The Religious Case Against Belief, and he's professor emeritus of religion at New York University. He'll join the panel at 11. We're coming right back. Stay with us.
100 years after his birth, Thurgood Marshall has become a character on Broadway.
As a boy, I came to understand two things marked my family: distinctive names and extreme stubbornness.
Lawrence Fishburne portrays this key figure in civil rights history.
People like Justice Marshall sort of, it's amazing how they kind of show up when we need them.
Thurgood, the play, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 FM WFAE, your NPR news source.
I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Talks explores our city and region to find out where we've come from and where we're going.
Trade and Trine was actually an old American Indian trading crossroad.
The momentum is flowing toward the center city. The population of uptown will probably double by the end of the decade.
The city has many possible futures. You predict what are the various types of Charlotte you might get in 25 years.
Growth, transportation, politics. We talk about it all with experts and you. Charlotte Talks, weekday mornings at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Ernie McLaney, Program Coordinator for the New Center for Sustainability at CPCC, as we talk about native plants and vegetation and restoring them to the landscape, because there's much at risk if we don't begin that move. We are learning today. Carol Bowie Jackson is also with us, a habitat steward with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, and Dr. Doug Tallamy, professor and chair of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware, who has written Bringing Nature Home, How Native Plants Sustain Wildlife in Our Gardens, which Ernie McLaney and Carol Bowie Jackson point to as the definitive work on this topic. Let's go to Gary in Cornelius. Welcome to the program, Gary.
Thank you very much, Mike. I'm as non-native as some of these plants, having lived here just over three years. My question for your experts has to do with grass. The builder of our home put in fescue, which in the change in the climate here does poorly. Our landscaper has suggested that we plant something called zoysia, and I wanted to know if that was a good idea or a bad idea relative to the kinds of issues they've been raising.
I'm not sure anybody here is a grass expert, but take
it. Yeah, in fact, I'm an anti-grass expert, but what I would recommend is whatever you put in, and I'm familiar with zoysia. I believe it goes dormant in the wintertime, and Dr. Tallamy might be able to provide more information, but is reduce your lawn as much as possible. Although I said earlier I do have some grass in the yard for my dogs,
When you reduce it, what do? What do you put in its place of all that green?
I've got natural area, which is just covered in mulch and has a few native bushes, and I also have a flower garden that's, you know, has lots of flowers in there. So you reduce it and put something else.
Anybody else want to take the grass question?
Well, when you have a small swatch of grass in your yard, that's not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, bluebirds like to have an open area for entry and exit out of their nesting boxes if you put one up.
Mm-hmm.
But there should be less grass in anyone's landscape and more native shrubbery plants, things like that, to support the biodiversity.
Just to answer the zoysia question, it does go dormant in the wintertime. And up here, that means entirely brown. And that's a normal behavior of that grass. I'm not sure if it would be all brown down in Charlotte or not, but a lot of people don't like that look. So you should think about that first.
There's low-growing ground covers that you could use instead of grass, like some of the winter greens, and we'd have to research that a little bit for
you.
Will
neighborhood associations allow you to do that?
It depends, and that's part of the process right now that we're going through, is to make this more acceptable. Like I say, habitat doesn't have to be messy. You can make it neat, and one of the tools of making it neat and acceptable is to put a border around it. When you're putting something in, you put a border, whatever that is. You could even put a border, a small path of grass around it. But you're telling to the world that this is intentional. This is supposed to look like this.
Right. If I could weigh in on that, the plants that are in the very formal gardens in Europe, many of them are from North America. So they're our native plants. They're exotics for Europeans, so they are attracted to them. But it's a very good demonstration that these plants can be used formally, just like any other plant. So again, I do want to emphasize what Carol's saying, is that going native doesn't mean you have to. It's not abandoning landscaping. It's gardening with native plants. So you can be as formal or as informal as you want.
Okay. Gary, thank you for your call. Let me go to Terry in Rock Hill. Terry, welcome.
Hey, Mike. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm a retiree of a year or so, and last year I took the Master Gardener course at York County. Clemson Extension Service does. The program's nationwide. It's a wonderful way for people to learn a lot about basic plant physiology and native plants, etc. To my chagrin, however, I learned that my yard was full of invasives, stuff I never thought of being foreign, but it was that way. This neighborhood is near Winthrop University, and most of the homes are older, built in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And so a lot of stuff that was very popular back then, including Japanese privet, Chinese privet, L.A. agnus, is rampant through the neighborhood. So I guess the good advice to replace things bit by bit as they die out, or if you can improve an area. But I think a lot needs to be done to educate nurseries, because most people go to commercial nurseries, they see stuff that they like, and there's no information about whether these things are invasive. And the people who sell them, they sell what is popular. There are a number of academic sites where you can get this kind of information. And I think we ought to direct our efforts more towards educating the people who sell the plants rather than expect the average person to know the difference.
How would you characterize our local nurseries in town?
Getting better. But it's still harder to find native plants.
Does that include the big box stores that sell plants?
Oh, goodness. A lot of times with the big box stores, you know, their corporate headquarters are doing the buying.
That's right.
And they, you know, they're shipping all over the country. So we may be getting something here that was intended for or native in California.
But most of the things that are sold at big box gardening centers are things like small flowering plants and some small shrubs. Is that a problem?
Well, they'll sell what the public buys, so it's up to the public to educate themselves on what is native and what is not. And one of the things I'd like to offer is that on our Central Piedmont website, you can download free pamphlets that talk about landscaping for native plants, for wildlife. And also there are courses at Central Piedmont that you can take on native flora and landscape management.
So if you wanted to make the transfer, start planting things that are native to the area, you could go to the cpcc.edu/CFS website and download a pamphlet that you're holding in your hand.
Right. This is called Landscaping for Wildlife with Native Plants, and we also have one, Managing Backyard and Other Urban Habitats for Birds, by the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Service.
Terry, thank you for your call. Harry in Black Mountain writes, please ask your guest to address the impact of zoning ordinances as they almost universally label as a nuisance yards that aren't the standard grass and bushes. We kind of just got into this, but he says, I have a friend who has repeatedly had to face this type of anonymous zoning complaint because of her plethora of wildflowers in her front yard. Wildflowers can occasionally be messy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, they have a cycle that they go through. You know, they grow, they bloom, and they go to seed.
Right.
And we love the blooming process, but a lot of us don't like the going to seed process. But if you'll be patient and observe, it's amazing what comes in that part of the process. Like black-eyed Susan, for example, mm-hmm. Those are great for butterflies. When they're in bloom, the butterflies are coming in. Actually, the plant itself will feed the caterpillars. The blooms feed the butterfly. And then when it goes to seed, the birds come in and eat the seed. It's a great plant, but sometimes it doesn't always meet our standards.
Sarah writes, please ask your guests what they think about using cultivars of native plants. For example, cultivars of native echinacea developed for particular color or size attributes.
Yeah, that's the most common question that I get all the time is whether a cultivar is as good as a native in terms of supporting wildlife.
What is a cultivar?
It's a genotype of the plant that has been modified most likely through plant breeding to produce a different flower color or a different leaf color or a different flower shape or a different growth form. So you've got basically the genetics of the native plant, but it's been modified to make something that's more attractive to us. And in most cases, we don't know how that really affects wildlife. I always tell people that if the modification did not change the leaf chemistry, then for things that eat the foliage, like the caterpillars that we want for the birds, it probably won't make any difference. But if you're changing the flower shape or the flower color, very often you're going to mess up the pollinators that depend on that flower because they're particular for the shapes and types of flowers that they can pollinate. And also it often reduces the amount of nectar that's produced. But it's a case-by-case basis, and most of the research hasn't been done yet.
Okay. Let me go back to the telephone. Scott in Charlotte, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm on the landscape committee of my town home association in the university area.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems we're dealing with is the decisions that the builder made, where he came in and just put tons of pine trees and all kind of different Bermuda grass everywhere. And, you know, I want to try to guide our community into being more green for the nature area. And, I mean, we're always up against everybody complaining against the way the grass is cut or the way the landscape committee is taking care of stuff. So, I mean, how can we – what do you think there should be a good way to energize people into accepting these changes, I guess, or going back to being green?
Yeah, how do you convince people that this is the way they have to go for their own self-interest?
Education. And one of the things Ernie was talking about, some of the resources that are available here in the area. I'm a composting plant instructor for Mecklenburg County. And we've got master composter classes that people can take, but you can also, we have a plant, Piedmont Landscaping and Naturescape Training that the county offers.
Is that at wipeoutwaste.com?
It's wipeoutwaste.com. Mm-hmm. Yes. And this has a huge list of native plants for the area. And it also talks about soil stewardship and water conservation, but you can sign up and go to one of these classes, or you can actually request, if you have a group of 12 or more people, you can actually request someone to come and
so in
give
Scott's
a class.
Case, that might be a good idea to help him spread the word among his homeowners
Absolutely.
Association. Who would he call?
Wipeoutwaste.com or Dana Glenn. And I'll get you Dana Glenn's phone number.
Well, she's reaching into her purse, Scott.
Yeah,
but wipeoutwaste.com is a place to start for that.
Right.
While she's looking, she is exactly right with education. There's a lot of information out there if people just take the time. And a lot of the landscaping companies are going after numbers, and they're not taking the time to do some research and find out about native plants that actually enhance the value of properties.
Now, is this a published number? Is this a mm-hmm. this is not a home number,
no,
right?
No. This is
Dana Glenn's number, Scott, 704-432-1970.
And I have just one more question. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of natural areas where we have a lot of a lot of people call them weeds and think they should be cut down, but I think they add to the natural landscape. And I'm just wondering, you know how you'll drive and you'll see a hill that was just overgrown with all kind of stuff. There may be, large, tall weeds that look, I almost want to say it looks like swish grass. But, you know, it just, I really think we should leave those alone. But a lot of people are afraid they invite critters, snakes, and small pests and stuff.
And you're getting a reaction here from Carol and from Ernie in the studio. Like, yeah, okay, well, that's what you want. Tell me about this. What kind of wildlife should we want to encourage in our backyards where we have children and pets at play?
Right. And that's one of the most common things is, oh my gosh, you know, a bear's going to come in and eat my kids. And, and of course that, the first thing we think about is that's why we should leave a lot of open space. That's why we need to preserve a lot of open space so that species that we sometimes consider nuisance will have a place to go. They don't want to interact with us any more than we want them to.
Okay.
So we need to leave a space for them. But what we want is a balanced ecosystem, and part of a balanced ecosystem is having a variety of bugs, very diverse bugs, but you got to go all the way up the food chain with that. So you do want a variety of species that are feeding on each other, that are providing a lot of benefits that we don't all yet realize. So yes, you may have some field mice that live in that meadow, but you've got hawks that come and eat those field mice. So you've got a diverse system.
Speaking of diversity, thank you for your call, Scott. Speaking of diversity, Dr. Ptolemy, you say that to reverse the decline of biodiversity, it will take native plants and lots of them. But these alien species that we've been talking about, don't they add to the biodiversity of an area?
Well, they add to the species count. So if you're just counting the number of species that are there, yeah, those are numbers. But if you go into a local area and count the number of species that are there today and compare it to what was there 300 years ago, you're going to have a far smaller number, even with those added plants that have invaded. Just look at your backyard and count the number of species that exist there. Compare it to the dense eastern deciduous forest that used to be there.
Mm.
So we have made our ecosystems really depauperate in terms of number of species and the diversity that drove the ecosystems that we used when we came to this country.
What do we do to start reversing this trend?
Plant. We've got to, you know, that 45.6 million acres of lawn is more than eight times the size of New Jersey.
I was just going to mention that.
We really need that much lawn.
We have planted over 62,500 square miles of lawn, 40 million acres of lawn. Each weekend, you say, we mow an area eight times the size of New Jersey to within 1 inch and then congratulate ourselves on a job well done.
Yeah. Carol and I both have plans this fall to take our front yards and greatly reduce the amount of fescue in the property. And that's one of the things homeowners should do. They should take a look, inventory what they have, try to learn what is native, what is not native, and just start from there.
Richard writes, I'm trying to find the snake video you mentioned on the program this morning. Where's the link on the Smell Like Dirt website?
Oh, go over onto the right side. There's a VOD pod and go. It says click all videos and all 22 videos will come up.
And what's the best source in his area? I'm not sure where he lives. He says he's living at about 500,000 at 5,000 feet altitude. But what's the best source in my area for native plants? I want to landscape my home with native species, but it's hard to find a good source, which is for my area, which is approximately 5,000 feet in altitude.
Yeah, and that I'm not sure where he is. I would say, you know, find a good nursery, not a home center, but a good nursery near you. Ask questions and do some Google searches, too.
All right. Where can we buy native azaleas, Linda writes. We bought one years ago from a man when we were driving home from the beach. We love it, but we don't know where we can get others.
And that's just going to take some research. And I will say that native azaleas are notoriously hard to transplant. They're real picky. More than planting with natives, you need to also make sure you're putting the right plant in the right place.
Carol Bowie Jackson's website is smelllikedirt.com. A lot of information there. Ernie McClaney, the program coordinator for the New Center for Sustainability at CPCC, their website, where you can also find information and download pamphlets, is cpcc.edu/CFS. And Dr. Doug Tallamy, professor and chair of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware's book is called Bringing Nature Home, How Native Plants Sustain Wildlife in Our Gardens. It will shed great, vast amounts of light on the problem and the solutions to it. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Herkey. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Aaron Sutton is our research assistant, and our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, go to WFAE.org.
And our program is made possible in part today by Ray Ward, Creative Marketing Communications, offering advertising, public relations, interactive media, and direct marketing services to businesses throughout the region, 704-332-9071, and by Mariner, giving people access to information to make better decisions and improve the bottom line with enterprise reporting solutions, balanced scorecards, and performance management dashboards. Mariner-USA.com.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition from NPR News. While you've been sleeping, we've been awake. Just barely in some cases, but nevertheless awake, watching the world from Baghdad to your backyard and all points in between. You can tune in and get prepared now for the day ahead with up-to-the-minute news, background analysis, commentary, and the latest on arts and sports. Wake up to the world with Morning Edition from NPR News.
With regional news, weather, and traffic, weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Mike Collins. Several years ago on this program, we investigated some of the beers being brewed professionally in Charlotte. We learned there's so much more to beer than what comes in a can. Then earlier this year, when the amateur craft beer brewers converged on Charlotte to showcase their original homemade beers at the 18th annual U.S. Open Homebrew Competition, we wanted to know, with so many commercial beers, why they brewed their own, and was it worth the effort? Find out in an encore presentation of Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7. WFAE. Highs around 90 with lots of sunshine today and again tomorrow. Lower 90s around 60 tonight. It was actually record-breakingly chilly last night. How nice. 77 degrees now at WFAE Charlotte, WFHE Hickory, your NPR news source.
From WAMU.